On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Maureen Blanc, trustee of the World Affairs Council and your moderator for this evening. It's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Gernot Wagner is a lead senior economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he co-leads the Office of Economic Policy and Analysis to advocate for market-based solutions to a wide range of environmental problems. His particular focus is on climate and energy economics. He teaches energy economics as adjunct faculty at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and is the co-author of the recently released book, Climate Shock, which you will all be able to buy and get signed later this evening. So here to discuss the economic consequences of climate change, please join me in welcoming Gernot Wagner. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tonight, we're going to have a conversation on the economics of climate. And I'd like to start with your book, Gernot, and the four factors that you identify that make climate change so hard to solve. In your book, you say that this problem really is unlike any other environmental problem, or any other public policy problem for that matter, in that it is uniquely global, uniquely long-term, uniquely irreversible, and uniquely uncertain. So let's start with the big four, as you call them. And can you walk us through your argument there?
I'll leave it to an Austrian to make up four strikes as opposed to three. So these are the big four, right? So it is certainly unique in the combination of those four. Or in other words, really what this problem is all about is not just what we know, and frankly, right, every book on climate change is about what we know about the problem. It is about what we don't know. And what we don't know may well dwarf what we know. Huge sense, right? So it is really, when we look at the uncertainties, for example, right? It's what we know is bad. What we don't know is potentially much, 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 much
just how
worse.
Bad.
Exactly. Right? Now, of course, right, as soon as you start talking about uncertainty, the immediate response is, oh, well, let's wait and see, right? Looks like we don't quite know enough, which, of course, is precisely the wrong reaction. Right? It's not so much uncertainty, it's climate risk that is the issue here. And risk means mitigate. Risk means, in a very real sense, mitigate. Right? Mitigate the risk itself. And of course, when it comes to climate, mitigate CO2. Price CO2, decrease CO2 going into the atmosphere. And frankly, the less we know, the more uncertainty, the more risk there is, the greater the case to do something about the problem in the first place.
So what are the unknown unknowns? But we don't know.
Well, if this was solely about the unknown unknowns, it would be a pretty short book because that's, in fact, right, by definition, in fact, unknown at this point. Now, to sort of go with the sort of Don Rumsfeld analogy here, essentially what we do know, right, the known knowns, that's, well, what goes into our models, that's what gets us the $40 per ton of CO2 price. The cost of $40 per ton of CO2 today, right? Every ton emitted into the atmosphere causes about $40 worth of damage. The known unknowns, frankly, those are the things that end up in the footnotes, right? So there are the sort of the big climate reports, and the things we do know are unknown. Well, we can't quite quantify them. We know they exist, so we put them in the footnotes. They're not part of the $40, but they're certainly there. And then the unknown unknowns, of course, those, you know, the black swans, in Nassim Nicholas Taleb's language, or Forrest Gump might use more colorful language, right? Life happens. So those are the things, by definition, we don't know. And frankly, the harder you think about this, the longer you think about it, the clearer it becomes that most of them can only go one way. And once again, they point in the direction that the less we know, the more risk there is, the more we ought to be doing about the problem in the first place.
You talk in your book a lot about this concept of free riders, and that many of us, you know, have no consequence in our own personal lives when we emit carbon, for instance, taking a flight from San Francisco to Boston, but other people do. Can you talk about this concept of free riders, and we'll lead that into our discussion about putting a cap on carbon?
I mean, it's a rather pervasive phenomenon, right? There's 7 billion of us who are free riding, right? So guilty as charged here, right? So when I board a flight in Boston going to SFO, right, I cause about, for round trip, 1 ton of CO2 emissions, right? That ton is at least about $40 worth of damage. Now, I get the benefit, right, privatizing the benefits, but we, in fact, socializing the costs, right? All 7 billion of us are paying a tiny, tiny fraction of that $40.
And how did you get to that $40 figure?
The known knowns. right? So basically, everything, so basically, this is literally every ton of CO2 emitted today over its lifetime, right? That stuff stays up there for quite a while, right? Decades, centuries, millennia. Those are the damages that each ton of CO2 causes, right? So as the average American, we emit about 20 tons of CO2 per year. As the average European, we emit about 10. I'm a dual citizen, so I get 30. and each of these 30 tons times 40, right, that's essentially the damage we cause. And of course, the free rider problem, the free rider phenomenon, is that it is not in any one of us individual interest to be doing enough about this problem, because it's all of us, all 7 billion of us, paying for the damage, while I get the benefit of hopping on that flight. Private benefit, socialized cost. Socialism, if you will.
And you talk about how,
in this case,
how it actually nets out to, instead of us paying the $40 as a free rider, we're actually being subsidized to not pay into the system through subsidies. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's even worse, right? So we can talk a lot about what the actual price ought to be. Right now, we're getting the sign wrong globally, right? So we are subsidizing fossil fuels to the tune of about $500 billion per year. So if you average it out of all the CO2 emissions, it comes out to about $15 per ton of CO2 that we are subsidizing the stuff, right? Going the wrong direction. So at the very least, let's try to get the sign right, as opposed to literally by being paid on average to hop on the plane and pollute, pay at least the $40 per ton.
So the concept and the premise of your book obviously is putting a price on carbon as it reflects its true price on society. And you talk a lot about the free rider concept. So here in California, our cap and trade system, so far, it's only been 2 years, it seems to be a success. It's working, our auctions are working, consumers, we saw a utility credit on our bill in the last few months, and most businesses seem to be adapting. So on the surface, it shows that climate action can be taken at the state level and implemented. So what's next? What's holding up, do you think, other states, other state actors, from following California's lead?
Well, here's hoping that we will all get our act together sometime soon. But in California right now, we have a price on CO2, in fact, of about $10, $12 per ton of CO2. And the framework, of course, that's in place, cap and trade, right? Limit overall emissions, hand out allowances to businesses, let individual companies trade, and decrease emissions as cost effectively as possible, is precisely the way to do it. Now, there's still more to be done, of course, even in California, but of course the beautiful aspect of it all is that the 8th or 9th largest economy on the planet is showing that it does work to put a price on CO2, right? Life goes on. It happens to be more decarbonized, more energy efficient, less carbon intensive, but life goes on in the end, right? Now, what does it mean for the broader political context? Well, in some sense, he is hoping that once again it's a It was a conservative governor in a liberal state who essentially pioneers a system for the country, right? I'm now living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so it was Mitt Romney, the conservative governor in liberal Massachusetts, who pioneered healthcare for the nation, or in this case, Schwarzenegger, fellow Austro-American, I'm proud to say, who signed cap and trade into law here. And once again, the hope or the very real possibility, of course, is that California is in fact demonstrating how it does work, and for Washington, D.C. to be paying attention sooner rather than later, hopefully.
So with your European background and point of view, who do you think's doing it well? You know, we hear a lot about the Scandinavian countries, and we hear about Germany and their efforts in renewables. Outside of the U.S., who should we be looking at and watching?
I mean, so Europe overall, the European Union, is certainly a good example of a region, 27 countries at this point, that have a cap on CO2 emissions, and in fact have a functioning cap and trade system in place. Now, you pointed out Scandinavia, right? You can always trust Scandinavians to do what is in the interest of the world, not necessarily in their immediate short-term self-interest. So Sweden is a good example. They've now had a carbon tax, carbon price in place for a couple decades. As of today, it is above $150 per ton of CO2. Now, guess what the average Swede talks about when they come home, have dinner with their family? Right? Not about the price of CO2. Once again, life goes on. It just happens to be much more energy efficient, decarbonized, essentially, the heating sector and the electricity sector in Sweden. And life goes on. Law of demand, right? The one thing we have in economics, literally, the one thing, the one law in economics, if price goes up, demand goes down. Works every single time. Mm-hmm. Certainly works for CO2. So from the this is sort of the point that economists like to make about, right? So the solution has been around for over a century at this point, turns out, right? No one's going to win a Nobel Prize for figuring out the solution to climate change, as it were, because the guy who came up with it died a decade before.
And who was that?
The first prize was given out. Mr. Pigou, Professor Pigou, right? Pigouvian taxes. Now, he was talking about rabbits, it turns out, not about CO2 when he was talking about it, but similar problem, similar solution. Price, internalize the externality, price CO2 in this place, and get out of the way. Law of demand.
You talk a lot in your book about some quick fixes that potentially might be out there, especially when you talk about the free drivers and this whole idea of geoengineering as a potential silver bullet. And as we sit here in Silicon Valley and think about the technology companies who are solving and tackling all these problems, I can imagine that over the next, 10 years or so, a startup will be venture-backed to take on some aspect of climate with a geoengineering project. And I was hoping you could walk us through your view of geoengineering as you see it. And I know you talk a lot about why it's a bad idea, but also, is it something that's going to come no matter what as a solution, given that we're well far beyond the mitigation phase at this point?
So geoengineering comes essentially in two flavors.
Do you want to define it for the audience, which might be helpful as well?
Sure. So, I mean, the first one is essentially what's commonly called solar radiation management.
Wow.
Essentially shooting stuff into the stratosphere, deflecting sunlight, and lowering temperatures. That's the scary stuff. And essentially, right, I wouldn't liken it to a silver bullet. I would say it's a tracheotomy for the planet, or chemotherapy for the planet, if you will. So, right, in some sense, right, you want your doctor to be ready with that procedure. You certainly don't walk into the doctor's office and say, could you please cut my throat? I always wanted to see what that's like. Or, right, to use the chemotherapy analogy, you certainly don't start smoking just because some experimental cancer drug worked on some lab rats somewhere. Right? So what that means for climate, right? That kind of geoengineering, essentially the kind that volcanoes, by the way, have been doing forever, shooting stuff into the stratosphere, dimming the sunlight for us, and lowering global average temperatures as a result. That's the scary stuff. I trust in many ways that there is no Silicon Valley startup tackling that one. But on the other hand, there are also plenty of forces, in fact, pointing in the direction that it's not a question of if, it's a question of when someone will want to do precisely that. Now, why is that? Right? So we talked a lot about the free rider effect. Right? It's in no one's personal interest to be doing something about global warming in the first place, even if we could, because there's 7 billion of us, at least a billion or so high emitters who are chiefly responsible for this problem. Well, for this kind of geoengineering, it's the free driver effect, in the sense that it is relatively cheap. It is so cheap, in fact, that you could imagine a country, an individual even, right, sort of your odd billionaire, who basically says, right, I've had enough of that, you know, storms threatening my beachfront property, let me see what I can do. And when you talk about sort of leverage, this is leverage. This is sort of atomic bomb territory leverage, where tens of millions of dollars, maybe $1 billion, could lower average global temperatures in sort of this crude geoengineering sense by enough to offset quite a lot of CO2 emissions. Now, there's a lot of drive toward that. There's also, of course, a lot of sense that this is precisely the wrong tack, at least the wrong tack to tackle now, knowing what we know about, well, what we don't know, frankly, about the costs, the true social costs of this kind of geoengineering. The other kind that I would actually, I wouldn't really call it geoengineering in a sense, but it does fall under this heading sometimes, what's sometimes referred to as air capture, basically taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. Right? Now, that's where I hope that someone in Silicon Valley, lots of people in Silicon Valley, are in fact working on this. Right? Now, what does that mean? Well, it's a very energy-intensive process, turns out. Right? It's a lot easier to just burn the stuff and burn fossil fuels and put CO2 in the atmosphere. We've been doing it
and
for
this
centuries.
This is like carbon sequestration and things like that.
Exactly, right? Okay. Now, carbon sequestration usually refers to taking CO2 out of smokestacks. Turns out that's a lot easier because it's concentrated in a smokestack. It's a lot more expensive to do it out of thin air, quite literally. But in fact, there are ventures out there already that are trying to tackle that. And in many ways, well, the real problem there is that it has many of the characteristics of what has caused the problem in the first place. Right? It's relatively expensive to do. And it's not in anyone's personal self-interest to be magnanimously doing it for the planet, mainly because it is, in fact, so expensive. That said, right, when you talk, let's say, Sweden, with a carbon price of $150 per ton, it may well be worth thinking about precisely that kind of technology.
In the clean tech sector, especially right now, seems to be on a nice up curve. Do you see any technologies beyond carbon sequestration coming down the pike here that will take carbon out of the atmosphere in a bigger way, more effective way?
Well, I think if it comes to actually taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, air capture is sort of the catch-all term for that. Now, frankly, when it comes to sort of exciting things happening in the clean tech sector, it's not so much air capture, it's not so much basically doing what you would do after the fact once you've released the CO2. It is, in fact, the excitement around, for example, solar PV photovoltaic prices decreasing by 80% in 5 years. So there is a lot happening, frankly, on the renewables, on the energy efficiency front, that in many ways also should give all of us quite a bit of hope that we are, in fact, able to turn the corner here.
You talk about the concept of insurance. You know, we insure ourselves for all different things in life. And this is probably one of the biggest human catastrophes coming our way. As you said, it's long, it's going to take a while to get there. Yet, we really haven't taken out any kind of insurance policy. Can you talk to that and how, is that a personal behavior modification that we all need to make, or is it something that, you know, we just don't get at this point?
Well, it won't surprise you that as an economist, right, it'll always come back to pricing CO2. And in fact, that's exactly the insurance premium in this case, right? So insurance really is a stand-in for talking about climate as a climate risk problem, as a risk management problem. And, well, the insurance premium we will be paying is, in fact, the price on CO2 in the first place.
So how does that relate to our everyday lives? So you say the $40 carbon per person, I think it's up to $800 a year, but we don't actually pay that right now. How, in the going into the future, how would that look to the average person? Would it show up in other bills, other parts of their daily life?
Well, it turns out, of course, we all do pay it right now, right? Just not the right person.
Right.
Right, so somebody is paying the $40 that my flight, the damages that my flight causes, just not me. I mean, I paid a fraction of the penny the same as you are paying a fraction of the penny for me to be able to fly across the country and back, right? That's the problem. The problem is, in fact, that all of us are paying for it, just not the person who's causing the problem in the first place, right? So, like, to use a financial analogy, at the Great Recession of late, well, by now it's a Wikipedia entry, right? Privatizing benefits, socializing costs. So the entire financial sector essentially was going through a very profitable period of essentially privatizing the benefits of your personal action, make you quite a lot of money, and if something goes wrong, someone else picks up the tab. Well, you're doing the exact same thing right now when it comes to climate. Privatized benefits, socialized costs. So someone is paying the cost already, just not the person causing the pollution in the first place. So like in many ways, right, it's only fair for me to be paying the $40 that my round trip flight will have cost. And of course, right now, there are plenty of policy instruments that you could think of that would do precisely that, and maybe even make me more money in the meantime, right? So by increasing a price on CO2, decrease payroll taxes, let's
so
say
where
at
exactly
the same time.
One of the questions is where exactly does that cost go? Is it, you know, carbon credits? Does it go into cleaner technology? Where exactly are, when you price carbon, where do those funds go? And I know here in California they go to a variety of pools of money, but maybe could you talk a little bit to exactly where the costs go?
Well, I mean, in some sense, the sort of somewhat flippant first answer is I don't really care where it goes, as long as you price the CO2 in the first place. Right? If the Europeans price CO2 and then take all the money and give it to bail out Greece, well, you've priced CO2. That's setting the incentive right in the first place. Now, of course, you could do doubly good with the money and, in fact, take the revenue you have just made, the carbon based on the carbon price, and either decrease other distortionary taxes, payroll taxes, labor taxes, right? Comes in under the slogan of why should we tax goods? Why not tax bads like CO2? Or for that matter, you take some of the money and subsidize renewables, subsidize energy efficiency improvements, and
build
essentially
do
doubly
rail.
Good. Build a high-speed rail, for example, right? And do doubly good with the money, exactly.
I want to shift the discussion a little bit to sort of the world stage and talk about, you know, what's going on. We've been all watching the terrible cyclone this week that hit Vanuatu. This question is about the Maldives, a nation that's been targeted as potentially disappearing from the impact of climate change. From your point of view, do you think, you know, the leaders, the UN, their ex-prime minister, et cetera, how much has been done for them? Are we following these smaller, the first wave of climate victims close enough, but are you seeing any attention being paid to these smaller countries that are literally right up against the impacts of climate change today?
Well, the short answer is, are we doing enough? Clearly not, right? So in some sense, right, the first order response to the climate problem ought to be, let's do something about the problem in the first place. Let's price CO2. Let's put the right policies in place. Now, of course, there's plenty of global warming already baked in into the system. There's plenty of sea level rise already baked in. Right? Even if we stopped emitting CO2 today, sea levels would be rising for decades, centuries, possibly. Right? So there's plenty of low-lying island nations. You don't have to even go that far afield, right? Coastal communities up and down the coasts here in the U.S. or many, many other countries that are much more vulnerable, of course, who will, in fact, suffer. Now, of course, it's not a secret, right? As usual, the rich will adapt. We'll buy our second air conditioner, or as a good environmentalist, we'll buy our first one. The poor will suffer. And that, of course, is, in many ways, the real problem here, that there's, given how global, given how long-term the problem is, the consequences aren't, in fact, felt by us here. They're felt by future generations, mostly in developing countries.
And you say in your book that the rich will survive, but the poor will not. I think I'm paraphrasing, but if we don't act, that those who can afford it will basically skirt climate, and those who cannot will be the climate That's victims. Yeah. And you know, as we start to watch some of this happening around the world, what do you think it's going to take for a global organization to really step up and create change? There's lots of, I was watching Davos and all the speeches on climate, yet we're still waiting for some kind of, action in that regard. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we did just have 200-year storms hit New York City within 2 years. All right, so was that enough to get a national climate policy in place? Apparently not. That said, it's clearly, right, once you hit Wall Street twice within 2 years, people start paying attention. Now, right, on that one, right, can I tell you when the next 100-year storm will hit? No, of course not.
The unknown unknown.
The known unknown in this case, right? Now, it's probably not going to take another 100 years. Right now, how many of these storms will it take? Does it take? That's anyone's guess. Let's hope not too many disasters, very real disasters, for us to do, in fact, react.
Mm-hmm. So we have a question about water. Sitting here in California, we have been advised that we're in for a 50-year drought at least. I don't know whether we're 2 years into it or 10 years into it, but with aquifers drying up and climate, no one's really talking about climate change. It's a drought. No one's linking it to any possible problem out there. What's your view on how to change that?
Well, in some sense, right, this is yet again part of the climate risk aspect of it all. Is it possible to link any particular storm, any particular drought for that matter, definitely to climate change? No, but that's not really the point either. Right? What we are talking about is that droughts, or the other extreme, flooding for that matter, right, just became more likely because of the things we are doing to the atmosphere. And then, once again, the question in many ways is, okay, what does it take to, in fact, move policy in a sensible direction? Now, let's hope it's not going to be a 50-year drought, where at the very end we suddenly wake up and say, okay, well, it looks like we ought to be tackling this after all. Now, on the other hand, really what it also calls for is, well, that there are, in fact, other problems that are very much correlated with climate change, global warming, that, by the way, ought to be tackled independently either way, right? Should we be putting sensible systems in place to price water sensibly, quite independently of what is happening on the climate front? Again, for an economist, that's a pretty obvious answer, of course. Right? And it's not just droughts in California. It's sort of plenty of other at environmental problems that are in fact very much linked to this global phenomenon, this all-consuming climate change phenomenon, that each of them deserves its own solution. Never mind that really what it also points to, of course, overall is, well, let's tackle the underlying root cause of some of these problems to begin with. We are back pricing CO2, tackling climate change in the first place.
So to keep the hard questions coming, so 2016 is an election, huge election. How do we get climate on the political agenda for the next presidential campaign? And how do we get every candidate in the primaries and finally, of course, in the general election to take a position on climate one way or another, tell us what they're going to do about it, and respond to the fact that the American public believes climate change is real and needs to be dealt with?
Well, in many cases, in many ways at this point, it's sort of an inescapable fact that, well, it was, I guess, the last two presidential elections already where climate change was in fact something asked in the debates, or at the very least something every candidate had to in fact take a position on. So in many ways, well, he is hoping that this time around, once again, it will in fact, at the very least in the general election, something that will in fact be on the agenda. Now, what are the best, most sensible sort of ways to get there? It's in many ways above my pay grade as an economist. on the other hand, the sort of inescapable fact of political life at this point is that, well, this is in fact one of the major issues that everyone, at the very least, ought to be asked about. What is your actual position? And no, I'm not a scientist is not the right answer.
Exactly.
Or I'm not an economist, for that matter, doesn't count either in this case. Obama had the perfect response to that in the State of the Union, right?
Yes,
I'm not a
did.
Scientist either, but I'll talk to them.
Yes.
And they tell me it is a problem.
So another climate book, Climate Shock. I know we've had many speakers come through and talk about the climate from every aspect. Why do we need another book on climate? And what are you hoping to, what's your message and what are you hoping to achieve?
I guess the core message in many ways is, right, this is not about what we know, it's about what we don't. And then when it comes to the solution, it's not about sticking it to the man, it's about sticking it to CO2. Right, so maybe just getting these two messages across already is quite a lot to achieve for one book. But essentially, the second aspect is, in fact, crucial. Right, this is not about sticking it to the man, sort of revolutionizing the way we do business overall. It is about rechanneling market forces in the first place, moving them in a direction toward low carbon, high efficiency, as opposed to the current path we seem to be on in the ever more carbon, low efficiency world. What it also means, of course, is that the solution, once again, is pretty near and dear. Right, price CO2 and get out of the way. It's about as simple as can be. It's about as low impact as can be. California is already demonstrating that it is, in fact, possible to do that, do it productively. Sweden, many other countries. Right? China is experimenting with 7 regional cap and trade systems right now, putting a price on carbon. India has a $1 per ton tax on coal. Many, many other countries are either thinking of or, in fact, putting systems in place that tackle the very root cause of the problem. And, of course, the big, big question is, what are we doing enough and on time? And, once again, here's hoping that we are, in fact, turning a corner.
We have a question. What do you think about the fee and dividend carbon scheme put forward by the Citizens Climate Lobby as more effective than the fee and carbon trade?
I mean, in many ways, right? So we can we can come up with with different names for the exact same thing. Once again, it is about pricing CO2. Now, fee and dividend in this case, really what it refers to is pricing CO2, taking the money and sending a check to every household, or for that matter, decreasing taxes, other taxes, labor taxes, payroll taxes, while we're at it. And in this case, British Columbia has in fact shown that that's exactly what is a productive way forward, politically feasible in that case, and is doing good things. Now, when it comes to sort of the specific policy proposals for, say, particular states here in the U.S. or the country, for that matter, well, a lot rides on the politics. And in many ways, well, it does, in fact, depend on what is more politically feasible and what will survive the political process intact to still have a system that prices CO2 properly and sets the right incentives.
Can you talk about the response by businesses to your book, or your book isn't out yet, but in general about what you're proposing? Who gets it? Who do you think is doing the right thing out there?
Well, in many ways, ironically enough, it's in fact those who are closest to of the financial sector, to risk management more broadly, that
interesting
for whom, right? So this isn't, in some sense, it might be a new approach to say, let's take risk management and apply it to climate, the climate problem or environmental problems more broadly. But it won't be a surprise, right, that someone who has made money on Wall Street managing risks for either his or her own money or for clients, for that matter, who would then say, well, climate change, well, of course it is a risk management problem. It ought to be a risk management problem. Let's think about it in exactly the same terms and at the very least come back to the privatizing benefits and privatizing costs as opposed to socializing costs while we're at it.
Is there any leverage to be had by this big effort at the university level to divest of energy stocks? A carbon tax and divestment strategy like Oxford and Harvard, will that happen anytime soon? And if at all, I know, and I think the University of California has said they will, but what impact do you think that will have on energy companies and business in general and the whole climate argument?
Well, in many ways, anything that can help put policy on the table, right? So like Stanford, for example, has divested from coal. Now, in many ways, it turns out they should have done it a lot sooner for financial reasons, not just for climate policy reasons. Now, of course, in this case, right, divesting from coal is, in fact, not just a good political policy decision. It's a fantastic economic decision, financial decision. And if and when they go hand in hand, even better. Right? Now, overall, the divestment movement, divestment campaigns, going to have the impact that its campaigners would like it to have? Well, once again, right? If that does in fact lead to the right kind of policies, and for example, energizes young voters to be voting green, quite literally in this case, voting for the right policies, fantastic.
Are you spending any time on campus with that message, or are you basically having that conversation among the economists?
Well, it is certainly a bit of both, right? So I can tell you when I teach my energy economics class at Columbia, I mean, frankly, one of the favorite student questions is precisely this, right? So what can I do? What can I do personally? Should I be spending my time advocating for divestment in this case? At Columbia, and as usual, I mean, the short answer is well. In some sense, if it doesn't detract from other things you could be doing, if it adds to the overall sort of message, fantastic, go for it. Right? Now, as an economist, I guess usually the bias then is to say, well, clearly there are trade-offs. Right? Could be doing one or the other. If you spend a lot of time, let's say, thinking about sort of individual action that you can take to make a difference personally, well, if it leads to more, if it leads you to not just recycle more, but to, in fact, vote in the right direction, ask for the right policies, fantastic. If it's a self-reinforcing satellite. Now, in some sense, what I'm deathly afraid of is that there are, in fact, very hard trade-offs that lead you to then say, well, right, so I've refused the plastic bag, the checkout counter, and then you board the flight. And you've sort of done, right, you've solved global warming for the day because you have sort of composted your garbage. If that's the case, right, I would urge everyone to think very hard about precisely those real trade-offs when it comes to individual action versus, right, policy action. And, well, my bias, of course, would be on the policy side. Right? If it's an either-or, go for the policy, mm-hmm. not for an individual action. If it's self-reinforcing, and then, of course, it is, in fact, both. And in many ways, it's not an either-or between these two. Right? It's a question of under which conditions does one apply or the other.
Mm-hmm. We sparked a lot of conversation about politics, and this question is, do you think there's a middle ground for climate deniers to reach the economic solution to climate disruption, or is it a lost cause?
Well, there are deniers and there are deniers, right? So in many ways, the risk management argument ought to appeal to precisely those who say, well, we can't be too sort of cocksure about the answer here, right? We just don't know enough. Well, if the answer is, well, yeah, that's kind of the point, right? We don't know precisely what the exact price of CO2 ought to be to the penny. Well, if there's uncertainty, if there's risk around that, it just means more action today, right? So if you tell me, well, climate science isn't settled, we don't know. We can't act. one answer, of course, is to in fact say, well, no science ever is, right? That's kind of the point of science. We don't declare sort of the end of scientific inquiry and move on. There's always more questions to be asking. The long answer, of course, is that we certainly know enough to act today. Right? The known knowns, giving us the $40 per ton of CO2, that every ton of CO2 is causing in damages. And then there's plenty we don't know, and most of that, the vast, vast majority of this, only goes in one direction. Right? The price, the proper price on CO2 can only be above $40, not below. So what we don't know, once again, is in fact a lot worse, potentially a lot worse, than what we do know.
And we have a question about, how did you arrive at that $40 rate of one ton of CO2 emissions?
Well, it turns out I didn't. It's basically three of the most well-established climate economic models that, in this case, the U.S. government, an interagency working group of the U.S. government, ran those three models, averaged the results, and derived those $40 per ton of CO2 emitted today in today's dollars. And once again, it is in fact the known knowns, right? It's basically everything we do know that feeds into these models. So just to give you a quick example of this, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago, in the second to last report, estimated sea level rise, as of course you would, right? As one of the major consequences. Now, it turns out the known knowns, right, what we knew happens, that fed into the models, that were fed into the models, for the most part included only one way that sea levels are going to rise. It's called thermal expansion. Warmer water takes up more space. Now, turns out we, of course, knew that ice sheets would be melting, and right, newsflash, melting ice raises sea levels. Melting ice sheets raise sea levels. Now, that was one of these known unknowns, right? Too much uncertainty to pinpoint one precise estimate as of 2007, this second to last IPCC report. So it was put in a footnote and didn't, in fact, enter the main figure of here's the sea level rise to be expected by the end of the century, for example. Now, turns out we did correct that. Scientists did correct that. The last report that came out October 2013 had, finally, an estimate of global average sea level rise to be expected because of melting ice sheets, not just thermal expansion. Now, it won't surprise you that those climate economy models are somewhere around 5 years or so behind the curve. So the first time we calculated the cost that each ton of CO2 causes, it was about 50% lower. It's about $21 or so per ton of CO2 for a number of reasons. One of the reasons was that it was using the climate models from 5 years ago. Only last year, when essentially the U.S. government reran these climate economy models using the latest iteration of these models, now we finally include, among several other things, the fact that ice sheets do in fact melt as temperatures rise and sea levels rise as a result. So that's just one indication yet again that these models are woefully conservatively biased, or lowercase conservatively biased, and in fact, of course, give us the known knowns, don't give us the known unknowns in this case, let alone the black swans, the unknown unknowns.
Great, thank you. We have a couple questions about China. One of my passions is transportation and electric vehicles, and I recently read that China's largest automotive manufacturer, BYD, I believe is their name, is testing electric cars here in the United States with Uber to see if they would be great taxi and transit vehicles. Can you speak to China? Is China significantly increasing global warming despite all their efforts? Are you seeing it start to turn or start to change? I know they're putting a lot of emphasis on the transportation sector as well as other major industries, but what do you think their recent efforts are to reduce CO2?
Well, it turns out if you look at the overall effects, news last week only, International Energy Agency has been calculating for about 40 years now CO2 emissions from the energy sector, arrived at the result that for 2014, for the very first time in 4 decades, CO2 emissions globally from the energy sector did not increase despite not being in a recession.
In China or across?
Globally.
Globally.
Now, of course, China was a major contributor, right? Both U.S. and China, of course, figure heavily into those overall calculations as the two largest emitters. And China, in fact, seemed to have, may have, turned the corner, right? So coal use, in fact, peaked in China and has decreased last year for the very first time ever. And as a result, partially as a result of that, overall CO2 emissions from the energy sector may well have leveled off for the very first time without decreasing economic growth at the same time, right? While China is still growing at 7.5 or so percent, on the economic side, CO2 emissions didn't.
And what are you attributing that to? Is it consumer behavior? Is it flatlining in growth in China? Is it other economic indicators from other parts of the world?
The good part in many ways, it's not flatlining growth, right? The economy was still growing while CO2 emissions decoupled, right?
Yeah.
So, certain kinds of policies that are in fact showing effect, right? On the one hand, pricing CO2 on the one hand, right, setting the right overall incentives in place, putting the right overall incentives in place, and then also sliding down the learning curve, as it were, for renewables, decreasing the price of solar PV, wind energy, and in fact deploying many, many more gigawatts of both than we had thought possible only very, very recently. And China, Germany for that matter, are in fact on the leading edge here when it comes to subsidizing renewables and trying to figure out what to do in order to industrialize renewables and make them cost competitive with fossil-based energy.
And you talk a lot about India. Can you, adding on India to that argument, what do you see happening in India?
It wasn't too long ago, the last time we had the potential of national policy in this country, the Waxman-Markey climate bill, cap and trade law, right? China and India were featured on page one of that law in the context of unless they, we won't, or we shouldn't, for that matter. Now, in many ways, of course, we should regardless, but more to the point, both China and India are in fact doing quite a lot already. I mentioned before India having put a dollar per ton of coal tax in place, which raises about $500 million dollars worth of revenue, which in this case is in fact spent on subsidizing renewables. Fantastic. Now, it's a buck a ton of coal, right? That's not yet enough to solve the climate problem for the rest of us, but of course it's $1 more than we had only recently, and it's certainly a step in the right direction.
This is an interesting question. Do you see the measures we need to take to tackle climate change impeding other areas of innovation, such as space exploration, for example?
If we do it right, then no. If anything, it is freeing capital to be doing more of it. What it comes down to is, right, so doing it right is putting a price on CO2 and then, either raising revenue for space travel, let's say, or for that matter, putting a price on CO2, lowering taxes elsewhere, making our tax system more efficient in the process, and freeing up capital for other ventures. Now, that's the sort of the dream scenario, as it were. And of course, what we should be doing is working very, very hard to, in fact, make that happen. On the other hand, limited government funds, if we prioritize and try to prioritize what to spend them on, and do in fact realize that the climate problem is one of the bigger ones out there, if not the biggest one out there. Now, does that take away directly from other human endeavors, space travel being the more prominent ones? We also need to be honest about what it really means, right? Economists like to think that there's no such thing as a free lunch. In this case, of course, right, there will in fact be trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to public policy, one of the many tasks politicians face is in fact to try to prioritize and try to see which are the biggest problems out there. In many ways, right, if we subscribe to the notion that there is no free lunch, then it may well mean that there are very, very hard questions to take. That said, if done right, there's some very good reasons to believe that green tax reform, pricing CO2, decreasing taxes on other things, is in fact not just a free lunch, it may well be a lunch you're paid to eat, growing the economy while protecting the climate.
So from space travel back to politics, if you were asked by the Republican Party to help them backtrack on climate change so that they now agree that climate change exists, how would you advise them to do that?
I guess in some sense the good news is...
How can they back away from their position, I guess, and save face and look like they agreed all along?
Erase certain Twitter feeds and so other histories. frankly, it comes down to the risk management angle once again. In the sense that when you actually think about it, you don't have to be 100% certain. All you need to know is the direction. So George Shultz just came out very recently, very publicly, saying, well, here's what Ronald Reagan would have done. Were he alive today, and were he tackling the climate problem? And yes, it involved the world risk management, or insurance for that matter. No, it's not a secret, right, that this is in fact, in many ways, the conservative approach here, both lower and uppercase conservative, as it were, is in fact to take the prudent path forward and to say, well, we ought to be embracing something that, whether you're a scientist or not, doesn't really matter in this case, right? If you know that there are enormous costs, there's a small chance of enormous costs and a pretty good chance of high damages just the way we are going today. You don't have to invoke sort of the specter of, you know, planetary catastrophe, catastrophizing, if you will, to realize that if you do take the risk management angle to any of this, to the climate problem writ large, it means what the standard solution is, right? So now, is that a sort of a political prescription for someone to basically say, oops, well, looks like I was wrong all along? Well, it's not just a Republican phenomenon that it's very difficult for politicians to say, right, I made a mistake, right? Politicians don't correct their opinions, they evolve in their opinions, I'm told. But I guess it would be a very intelligent evolution indeed to be worrying about the climate problem, not simply because it's politically expedient, although that, of course, hopefully will sooner or later play a role here as well, that people do in fact get elected based on their climate stance, their positive climate stance, but simply also because it's the prudent public policy to take. And frankly, you could do a lot worse than say, well, let me just look at this from a pure finance perspective, from a pure financial or economic perspective, and arrive at the conclusion quite independently that it is the only prudent way forward to do look at the risk management side of things and figure out that pricing CO2 is the cheapest path you can possibly take.
And do you think we'll see another Newt Gingrich, Nancy Pelosi ad coming together and talking about climate change?
Well, it may not be the two of them at this point, but hopefully.
That was very exciting, yeah. A few more questions. This comes about back to CO2 pricing. How will CO2 pricing affect developing countries? Will they be expected to price the same as the large emitters?
In some sense, right, global problem, global solution. So if you put an economist in front of a blackboard or whiteboard and ask for the sort of best possible global solution, well, it is a globally uniform price on CO2, a global cap on CO2. Now, at the end of the day, of course, it is in fact about half a dozen emitters, the EU being one of them, 27 countries, in that case, that make up for the vast majority of emissions. And of course, we've already seen that, frankly, in the US-China climate deal last November. Right? You have the two major emitters come together and in some sense surprise all of us by making a deal that in the very, very narrow, short-termist sense may not have been in the self-interest of either country individually, right, on sort of the quarterly basis. On the other hand, of course, they did take that step forward. It did have a lot of momentum. And well, now we see quite a lot of movement in many, many other countries that make up quite a lot of the overall percentage of overall CO2 emissions, overall greenhouse gas emissions. So no, it does not in fact take every single country, right, all 190 plus of us, to agree on the perfect uniform solution. Europe has already taken the lead. The US and China now are part of that club. And if you add a couple more large emitters, you make up quite a lot of the problem, and of course also quite a lot of the solution.
Great. Thank you. Well, I think we are coming to the end of our time with you, and it's been a great hour. I think that we have time for one final question, and it's going to come from me. So I was very depressed over the weekend. I went to a 2-year-old's birthday party, and I saw so much plastic and high fructose corn syrup being ingested by children. and parents merrily standing by, and I was like, I can't believe this is happening, that this is okay. And these were relatives, as a matter of fact, so it was even harder to think about that. But I came home and I turned on Al Gore, and I got re-inspired that we do have solutions out there. And he talks a lot about we can solve this problem. He also says he thinks that this is the year of climate. So I wanted to ask you, is this the year of climate? How do we stop financing climate denial in politics? We're all waiting desperately to hear what the Pope has to say in the next few months, but is it possible that we've really reached a turning point here in the conversation around climate and that we're on a sort of an upward trajectory?
Well, given that we've reached a turning point when it comes to CO2 emissions from the energy sector and we are on the downward trajectory, or at least we have flattened emissions, between Al Gore, the Pope, and that U.S.-China deal and sort of plenty of other things, positive things happening, I guess I wouldn't say so much it's the year for climate, it's the decade for climate. And in fact, this is in fact the one decade where we ought to be turning the corner on global, not just CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions overall. There's a lot of hard work ahead of us to do achieve that turn to safety, as it were. But at the end of the day, it is possible. It's doable. It's the only sensible path forward. And if done right, it's certainly the cheapest way possible we can do this by tackling the problem head on, sticking it to CO2, not sticking it to the man.
Great. So this concludes our program for this evening. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council, join me in thanking Gernot Wagner for his excellent discussion.